Funding for this edition of Think Tank with Steve Adubato has been provided by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. New Jersey Sharing Network. Newark Board of Education. PSCNG. Powering Progress. Community Food Bank of New Jersey. The Burke Foundation. Myron and Elaine Adler Private Foundation, in support of the Adler Aphasia Center. The Fund for New Jersey. And by United Airlines. Promotional support provided by CIANJ and Commerce Magazine. And by NJ Biz, providing business news for New Jersey for more than 30 years, online, in print, and in person.
Hi, folks. Steve Adubato here. Way more importantly, he is back. We got him. He has a powerful, compelling, important book. He's Professor Eddie Gloud, who is the author of America, USA, How Race Shadows the Nation's Anniversaries, and also a professor of African American Studies at the Princeton University. Good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you, too, Steve. How are you? I hope you've been doing well, man.
I have, and I want to get right to this. There's so much about this book that I agreed with, so much of it I disagreed with, and so much I want to talk about. Here's the first one. And you do this early on in the book. It's a quote, and I want you to explain it because it's, I don't know if people think it's out of context or not, but your context matters most. I do not love America and never have, especially now. You were talking, I believe, about coming up to the 250th anniversary of our country. We're taping this in late July. It'll be seen later. Eddie, what exactly does that mean? And does it mean exactly what it says?
You know, I think it means exactly what it says. In so many ways, Steve, I was trying in that with that first sentence to hold off the kind of idolatry of the state. There are a lot of folk who run around and wrap themselves in the flag, who declare their love of country, and they embrace policies that harm everyday people. I don't love abstractions. Right, I love people close to the ground. So the first thing that the sentence is supposed to signal is this shift in emphasis, right? And the second thing is also an argument with James Baldwin. Baldwin says in Notes of a Native Son, and we've talked about this before, that he loves this country more than anything, and because of that, he reserves the right to criticize it perpetually. Well, I don't begin there because of the third point, because of wound. I grew up in Mississippi. My dad was the second African-American hired at the post office in Pascagoula, Mississippi. And that's high cotton back in the day. We had a middle-class life as a result of that government job. And he moved us from one side of town to the other. And as I was playing with my Tonka truck in my new neighborhood, and I imagined the kid as blonde and blue-eyed or red-haired and green-eyed, and I'm playing with my Tonka truck, and his dad comes out and he screams, "Stop playing with that N-word." And so I had to grab my truck and go inside. So at that moment, the country, that man in the country told me what it thought of me. And then I had to go inside and my parents had to get to work to teach me how to survive it, to not believe what the world said. So I wanted to hit those three registers so I can get to something more fundamental, Steve. That is a love for the people close to the ground in spite of all of this and what that might mean in our 250th year.
You know what's so fascinating about that? As I was reading about that experience, and by the way, the book, so powerful, go out and get it now. When you were saying that, and then later on, or in the book, you say this several times, you mentioned, okay, that was then, and I'm a little bit older than you, Eddie, but that was a few years ago. You're a kid, it happens, right? Eddie Gloud is a professor, a distinguished, highly respected professor at Princeton University, Barack Obama elected president of the United States. There are many who think, and I'm not going to lie, there's a part of me that was saying, boy, I feel for as much as I can because I didn't experience what Eddie did. I know my grandparents experienced from Italy as they were considered, quote, less than white. And for people who don't believe that's true, go back and check out that history. And I think to myself, I may not understand what Eddie is saying, but there are many who would argue, but Eddie, that was then, this is now. You say what?
So this is part of what motivated the book, right? So here we are in this moment. As I wasn't writing it at the time that, you know, the Voting Rights Act was gutted.
But they're by the Supreme Court.
Right, or they're engaged in massive redistricting that's going on throughout the South. But there's been an all-out assault on American history, an all-out assault on DEI, whatever that might register for some folks. The end of federal contracts, the end of affirmative action. We see Princeton in my lifetime. It's a couple of years ago. It's after the affirmative action decision, Steve. The class that they admitted was the lowest number of African Americans admitted to Princeton since 1968. And so here we are in the 250th year of the country. And I can point to, people can point to me as the exception. Right? They can point to the election of Barack Obama. But here we are in the 250th year with forces claiming and arguing that ours must be and must remain a white republic. Now, that doesn't mean that it's exactly the same of what happened to me in 1977 or 1978, but there's something, there's a through line here that I'm trying to unpack that has everything to do with the contradiction at the heart of the country. And so slavery is no more. Of course it's no more. And Jim Crow was better than slavery because people were ostensibly free. They didn't belong to people, but Jim Crow was Jim Crow. And you still, even with the Black president in office, and I write about this in Democracy in Black, even with the Black president in office, you still have what I call the value gap, this belief that some people, because of the color of their skin, ought to be valued more than others. And that then determines and dictates the distribution of benefit and burden.
Couple things. Go back on our website. Will be up right now, steveadubato.org. Look at previous incredibly important interviews because of him, because of Professor Gallaud. Talking about his other books, but also talking about James Baldwin, who is a very important figure in Eddie's life and also in the lives of millions of Americans. I'm going to follow up on this. In the book, you talk about two Americas. The two-ness, two Americas, double consciousness. And it's white and it's black. And here's my dilemma with it. And many of the people you describe as, well, they're white. Sometimes in the book, I felt like you put us all in one category. And there are some of us who don't believe that we belong in that category. And then you argue, you talk about the pretense of liberalism, like somehow, whether you call yourself liberal, progressive, open-minded, supporter of civil rights, whatever it is, that all of us who are white or non-black, a person not of color, that we are all Trump-supporting,
yeah,
white supremacists, all fall in one category. And that, for me, is a real struggle, Eddie.
No, I can hear that, Steve. Absolutely. So what I was trying to do in that moment is that I said, wherever the white American shows up, right, we have to deal with the calamitous consequence. Now, what do I mean by that?
Yeah, the white American.
Exactly. It's a category. It is a category that carries with it a belief in racial hierarchy. James Baldwin has this wonderful formulation, Steve. He says, I happen to love a lot of people who happen to be white, and then they're white people. And he's making that distinction, and it's really important because there are those whose racial identity is just part of the inheritance. It's not their the way in which they see the world. And then there are those who are invested in the hierarchy of value that comes with that racial identity. So this is what I mean. The country has a divided soul. It imagines itself at once as a beacon of freedom and as a white republic.
And as the greatest country in the world, as many of us say.
Yeah, right. But it does so in light of this double consciousness, that it is a beacon of freedom and a white republic. And it's embedded in the Constitution. We see it with the Three-Fifths Clause.
Right.
We see it with the Fugitive Slave Clause. We see it across the board, right? We see it in the history of naturalization law. First Naturalization Act, 1797, only white property men could be, right, citizens. We see it in the very ways in which your ancestors, right, were treated, right? Because there's a sense in which when the Klan is reborn in 1950, right? Or 1913, right? There's this moment where they are really worried about these swarthy Europeans coming from these S-hole countries. They want Nordic European, right? Because they
don't want people from Southern Italy.
Right.
They don't want people from Naples or Sicily or any place that where people were darker than those who were whiter.
Right. They didn't want Irish.
But why are we all the same? Respectfully, Eddie, then why are we? And by the way, I also want to get to the Trump issue, because it also the implication is that, and many of my friends voted for Donald Trump. But in the book, the implication is if you voted for Trump in 16, 20, and 24, that inherently you must have racist tendencies to vote for Trump. And you believe that, Eddie?
I do, Steve. I do. I do not believe. I think in 2016, the Venn diagram between the Bernie Sanders voter and the Trump voter, there's all this overlap in between.
Sure.
Right. And I think it's really important for us to understand the kind of populist undertow to Trumpism. And populism in the United States historically has been driven from the right, not from the left. Historically, it has had this nativist undertow to it in interesting sorts of ways. And so I don't believe, given what Trump has done, given the way in which he's mobilized hatreds and grievances, given the way in which he has asserted the idea that the country belongs to certain people, and the way in which there's been a two-pillar assault on two pieces of legislation passed in 1965 that fundamentally changed the nation, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the Immigration Act of 1965.
That's right.
And so there is a sense in which people like him and Stephen Miller, they're white nationalists. And so I don't understand what would motivate people to vote for these people who are willing to throw away the country because they insist on it belonging to certain people.
I got to challenge you on this.
Sure.
I sat there and I went, 2016, Trump wins for a lot of reasons, one of which is the Democrats put up a candidate in the eyes of many who was weak, Hillary Clinton. Okay. In 2020, Biden wins. Okay. Now, Biden, the Democrats, forget about Trump for a second. The Democrats go, you know what? Let's put him up there again. What? Yeah, let's put him up there again. And I'm not going to go through and check out our previous interviews with people who've done biographies on Joe Biden. By any reasonable standard, not ready, not prepared to run in 2024. Okay, let's last minute. Let's get him out. Let's put Kamala Harris in. And then she's not ready. She's not the candidate potentially she could have been. Not a strong enough candidate. There are many who are arguing right now that one of the reasons Trump won, in spite of, by the way, not mutually exclusive, Eddie, but one of the reasons is that Democrats consistently put up crappy candidates against Donald Trump. And he could be beaten with another candidate, white or not, black or not, Hispanic or not. That's just a stronger candidate. Why is it all about Stephen Miller and Trump and their rate and their white supremacist tendencies?
Right. So let me stipulate to everything you just said.
Go ahead.
The Democratic Party is part and parcel to blame for the current state of the country. I just want to concede that. In Democracy in Black in 2016, I was a part of those folk who refused to vote for Hillary Clinton, right? Because I was in the state of New Jersey, right? And I thought because I was in New Jersey, I could vote my conscience. But I urged people who were in battleground states to vote for her because of the threat that Donald Trump represents.
New Jersey is a Democratic state and she wasn't going to lose it. Go ahead.
Exactly. So I could vote my conscience. So, but look at this though. The power of Trump's political ascendancy is in the math. And the math is driven by his ability to turn out low propensity white voters. So if you look at the number of voters who voted for Kamala Harris, right, in 2020, it is one of the largest voter turnout in the history of the country. How did Donald Trump win? It wasn't just simply because she was a bad candidate, because she put up historic numbers in terms of turnout. It had everything to do with something that Donald Trump has done since 2016. His ability to turn out low propensity white voters. And those low propensity white voters are motivated in part, not just simply by, you know, a bad Democratic candidate or by populists. They're motivated by grievance. They're motivated by feeling left behind.
Grievance about what, Eddie?
Grievance about big government putting its thumb on the scale that will allow these people, black and brown people, and people who don't work hard enough to get in front of the line to reap the benefits of the country while they themselves are struggling to make ends meet. This is where the Bernie Sanders Venn diagram, where it overlaps, but then it's the culture wars. It's the red meat that's thrown on top of it that then motivates these folk. On top of course, the worry about the administrative state, the deep state, on top of the Epstein, on top of the pedophilia of the Democratic Party and the like, the conspiracy theories. But when you listen to Tucker Carlson, when you listen to Marjorie Taylor Greene, when you listen to Megyn Kelly, or even at times, Joe Rogan is a complicated figure in this regard, you hear underneath it, Steve, this ugliness that then motivates those low prevent the people who don't turn out because they did the math. They're more of us than them.
To watch more Think Tank with Steve Adubato, find us online and follow us on social media.
At the Burt Foundation, we know a healthy beginning changes everything. In the first 1,000 days from pregnancy through age 2, the brain builds the foundation for lifelong health and learning. But in New Jersey, too many families face barriers to prenatal care, postpartum support, and quality childcare. We work with partners across the state so every family can access the care, connections, and resources they need. Because when families are supported early, children and communities thrive.
For New Jersey kids, for New Jersey seniors, for New Jersey families, unite to end hunger for the Community Food Bank of New Jersey, the state's largest anti-hunger, anti-poverty organization that gives hundreds of food pantries, soup kitchens, and nutrition programs across the state the food and resources they need. Unite to end hunger.
Next, please. Okay, we need a neutral expression. Sir, you're smiling.
Oh, am I?
Over 1 million lives in the U.S. have been saved by organ donation. So when you choose to become a donor, you're doing something good, which can make you feel really good.
Next.
Register today at njsn.org.
The white grievance part.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is tied to the double consciousness, the two-ness of America, the polarization, the race problems we have in our country on so many levels. But I'm curious about this. Do you believe someone can experience some degree of grievance who happens to be white and feeling that there are some advantages that people are getting that their children are not getting, but that those people are not inherently racist, but they genuinely believe that and don't want to see someone who's black, brown, Hispanic, other, not achieve, but they're worried about their own kids? Why does that inherently mean they're racist?
No, I think part of what the book is trying to show is that—
By the way, here's the book, America, USA, How Race Shadows the Nation's Anniversaries. By the way, Eddie goes through— I'm sorry for interrupting, Eddie. Oh. He goes through 1776, 1876, 1926, the bicentennial in 1976, and also the 250th. Go ahead, pick it up, Eddie. I'm sorry.
So the point is that history haunts. So absolutely, there's the case. I mean, that there are some folks who hold the view that their kids are not getting access to Princeton, that their kids aren't getting the same opportunities because we're trying to, in some ways, live up to a notion, to the ideal of a racially just society. And by virtue of that, some people are bearing the burden because we've been sold this bill of goods that is a zero sum game, right? As the likes of—
You gotta take it from me. If you get it, you gotta take it from me.
Right. And so while the riches of the rich are hogging everything, and we're arguing over these crumbs, but the way in which that argument takes place often is not in relation to oligarchs who are stealing and hoarding. It's really about these others who are not us stealing our opportunities. And part of what I wanted to say is this, is that that history haunts us. For give you a quick example, Steve, you
could
be committed to states' rights, that you are skeptical of big government. But in the history of this country, states' rights always carries with it in tow a deep skepticism about the federal government's ability to address slavery, ability to address racial segregation, ability to address poverty, and the like. So even if you hold those views without an explicit kind of commitment.
States' rights.
Right. So part of what I'm suggesting here is the history that we have to confront and encounter.
Yeah, to Teddy's point, by the way, people talk about states' rights. We get that in theory and in practice to some degree. If it were not for the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision by the Supreme Court, separate but equal, not okay. Ask ourselves, if the Supreme Court had not done that, that's federal government, that is not state government, which states would have said, well, states' rights, we'll do what we want to do. That being said, I'm not going to make Eddie's argument, but I'm going to, listen, I'm a baseball fan. Are you a baseball fan, Eddie?
Of course.
Okay, I'm a Yankee fan.
Good for you.
Well, I don't know if it's good for me or not. So this sounds crazy, but whether I'm at a game, but most of the time watching, it's harder to find on streaming services these days, middle of the seventh inning, God bless America, like a weirdo, I get up and I stand there and I, God bless America. And I sit there and I look and I see, and just about everyone's standing. And I think to myself, there are some people who don't want to stand right now. And what do I feel about those who choose not to? My first reaction is I'm pissed. Second of all, I go, wait a minute, hold on. That's what one of the reasons why this country is great, is because they have the right to do that. Do you?
I stand. I don't often sing. I rarely put my hand over my heart. No, I rarely do. And I think it's because of, you know, one of the things, and Steve, how can I put this? I come out of a tradition where this country was cruel. My professor at Princeton, two of them, give you two stories. At the height of their careers, Albert Raboteau wrote Slave Religion, the dean of African-American religious history, studied at Yale under Sidney Alstrom. He didn't grow up with his father because his father dared on the coast of Mississippi to challenge a store owner who disrespected his wife, and the store owner blew his head off, shot him in the face. Cornel West tells the story.
Great Cornel West.
Tells the story of jumping in a pool in Sacramento, California, not in Mississippi, but Sacramento, California, and they emptied the water while he was in it. I grew up in a place where my dad wouldn't stop by Ed's Drive-In because they wouldn't serve in. And we loved their crinkle fries and their chili cheeseburgers. So I come out of a tradition, Steve, where the relationship to the country is vexed. It's blues soaked. And the idea that my love should just simply flow when we've had to bury our dead and the country runs past it so quickly.
Not all of us, Eddie.
I know, but this is the point. But this is the point I'm making, that the expectation of gratitude, the way in which we dealt with, and I talk about this in the book, the way in which we dealt with racial justice as a philanthropic enterprise, as a charitable gesture, as something the country has done for us, as if it's the possession of some people to give and to take away. And here we are in the 250th year, and people are having to raise babies in an environment where folk is saying that their dad or granddad's achievement was only because of affirmative action, because we gave it to him. He didn't earn it. And what I'm trying to do is to unpack the story that makes all of that possible, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. In the couple minutes we have, I need to ask you this, which I believe I ask you every time. And I think we've done four interviews with Eddie so far.
We sure have.
If I got this right, you've always said there's some degree of optimism in you. This book is not an optimistic book.
No.
But then Eddie, respectfully, if it's not optimistic and you're not optimistic and you're one of our leaders, We are the leaders we've been looking for. Your book, not mine. That's your book.
Yeah.
But if you're not, then what are we supposed to do?
We have to grow up. And let me say what I mean by that, Steve. It's a blues-soaked hope at the end of the book. I have music throughout the book. Each chapter has a musical epigraph. I commissioned a piece by the classical composer Joel Thompson, and he wrote this gorgeous, beautiful piano concerto entitled "And Blue." It's beautiful to hear. It's the argument of the book. But what does it mean to have a blues-soaked hope? It's not that we end up in this kind of with this melodramatic vision of clear heroes and villains. We understand that the devil is in us. That when we look for the evil, that's all we need to do. To look for the bad, look in the mirror, it's us. And part of that recognition, right, is to have a tragic sensibility that allows us to grow up so that we don't see ourselves as always already perfect. My student at the end of the class, my Baldwin class at Princeton, she wrote this wonderful paper. She was from Texas, Steve. Gorgeous, gorgeous human being. She was a neuroscience major. But Baldwin had her on the ropes. She came into my office crying. I don't know if I want to have a white boyfriend anymore. I just don't know what to do. And, you know, and she wrote her final paper on Baldwin's notion of love, trying to chart it from Notes of a Native Son to the last book, Evidence of Things Not Seen, trying to look at how does Baldwin's idea of love shifts in light of all the dead, all of the horror, all of the disappointment. And she wrote this sentence that I live by now. She said, "Perhaps it's not hope what we need. What we need to do is to tell the truth, which is just as lasting. Tell the truth with love, but lit by rage." In my moment, it's not to give us some easy optimism, but to give us hope by telling the truth,
right,
with all the rage that I can muster in light of our 250th year in the moment we find ourselves.
Thank you, Eddie. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Thank you for the conversation. Thank you for the book. And thank you for just being you. That's Eddie Gallant. I'm Steve Adubato. Thanks, Eddie.
Man, just my heart. You're amazing. Appreciate you.
See everyone next time.
Think Tank with Steve Adubato is a production of the Caucus Educational Corporation. Funding has been provided by Hackensack Meridian Health, New Jersey Sharing Network, Newark Board of Education, PSCNG, Community Food Bank of New Jersey, the Burke Foundation, the Adler Aphasia Center, the Fund for New Jersey, and by United Airlines. Promotional support provided by CIANJ and Commerce Magazine, and by NJ Biz. To see more Think Tank with Steve Adubato programs, visit us online at steveadubato.org. If you would like to express an opinion, email us at info@caucusnj.org. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/steveadubato PhD and follow us on X at Steve Adubato.
At the Burke Foundation, we know a healthy beginning changes everything. In the first 1,000 days from pregnancy through age 2, the brain builds the foundation for lifelong health and learning. But in New Jersey, too many families face barriers to prenatal care, postpartum support, and quality childcare. We work with partners across the state so every family can access the care, connections, and resources they need. Because when families are supported early, children and communities thrive.
For New Jersey kids, for New Jersey seniors, for New Jersey families, unite to end hunger. For the Community Food Bank of New Jersey, the state's largest anti-hunger, anti-poverty organization that gives hundreds of food pantries, soup kitchens, and nutrition programs across the state the food and resources they need, unite to end hunger.
How long you been waiting?
About a half hour.
Brutal. This keeps up, I'm gonna miss my pickleball game.
I've been waiting 8 years for a kidney. What can you do?
Over 100,000 people in the U.S. are waiting for a life-saving transplant. but you can do your part in an instant. Register as an organ donor today at njsn.org.